Hello, this is Jerry Pippin. On this Conspiracy Files program, we are going to present the story of a hand-picked cold warrior who found out the hard way that the government has ways of protecting its covert, dirty little secrets, even at the expense of some of its strongest allies. John McCarthy had a prize duty assignment with Special Forces in Southeast Asia during the 1960s. Stay tuned for a shocking story as told by a man who lived it. When this program is over, you will understand that conspiracy is the standard operating procedure of the United States government. John McCarthy, it's a pleasure having you on the air with me.
Thank you, Jerry.
How are things in Southern California?
They are warm today and sunny. And no clouds in the sky, nice, clean, fresh air in the ocean.
Now you're getting ready to go to Europe. You'll be gone for, I guess, a month or so.
A little longer than a month.
And you've been quite the world traveler in your whole career, and we'll get into that in a little bit here. What I thought I would do is just get you on the air with me, and I appreciate you consenting to do that, and letting our audience know a little bit about John McCarthy.
Well, in fact, my earliest recollection, after having been born in Boston, was getting on a very large plane, which happened to be a Pan Am Clipper, four engines.
Oh, yeah, I remember seeing pictures of those things.
Yeah, and flying off across the United States to Seattle from Boston, and watching the Great Lakes go by and looking like puddles, and then going from Seattle to Japan on the USS Constitution, which took about 21 days going across the ocean. And I met up with my dad, who was there in the service with the occupation forces in late 1946, and we spent about 2.5 years in Japan and moved back to Kansas and then back to Boston for a year and then over to Germany for 3 years and back to the States and so forth. And then when my dad retired, I went in.
I started to say, you followed his tracks, I think, into the military.
I did, of course, I've seen different ways of life and how people lived all over the world and had comparisons with my own, and I've learned languages when I was a youngster. And
how many languages do you speak now?
Oh, just a couple now, just German and Spanish. But I've lost most of my Japanese.
Well, that's two more than me.
It's amazing how many words are the same. And you know, it's so easy for a child to learn because there's no barriers there. And I ended up being my interpreter in Japan between our hired help and my family. And same thing happened in Germany. But in both cases, I asked my dad, when we were downtown Kobe, which was had been an industrial city, an aircraft manufacturing city, and the place was in rubble in late 46 as a result of firebombing during World War II. And I asked my dad what happened, and he said there was a war here. And I said, well, why? And he said, because the wrong guy was in charge. He said, but the Japanese people are very industrious, learn their language, they're great engineers, and pay attention to what they say, they're very kind people. So I did that, and then when we got to Munich, Germany in 1953, I had a similar question, because one square block of the city of Munich had been preserved in rubble. And I asked my dad what happened here, and he said, well, we had a war. And I said, well, why? And he said, because the wrong guy was in charge. Well,
it seems to be the thing that goes on through history.
It does. And when I got to Vietnam, I found out the wrong guy was in charge, too.
Yeah.
But
in fact, you mentioned...
Actually, it was on the other side.
Yeah, right. I understand. You mentioned Kansas, and you just mentioned Vietnam and Southeast Asia. Your dad, he was stationed where in Kansas?
In Fort Leavenworth.
Well, you went to Fort Leavenworth later.
I did go,
but not the best way.
I went to what they refer to as the long course. They have a short course and a long course at Leavenworth, And that's at the Commanding General Staff College.
In other words, you were a prisoner.
Yes, and people who are polite refer to me as going to the long course. Yeah, and it's called the United States Disciplinary Barracks. We're jumping a bit ahead, but it's not a barracks at all. It was a penitentiary, which because of its conditions and the way people were treated, has been torn down a few years ago.
You were sentenced to hard labor. I don't know. Does that really mean what it says?
Not making little ones out of big ones anymore as it used to. It's more isolation, confinement, and they do have work programs within the system to make license plates and decals for cars at different military installations, and they have a farm unit which raised cattle and chickens. We had like about 3,000 chickens out there.
Now that's military prison. Is it all Army?
Well, at the time it was Army and Air Force, and I understand now, since I graduated from that organization in 1969, they have since changed, and I think the Navy and the Marines and the Coast Guard are doing their R&R there at this time.
Now, you know, on your website, and give it for our radio listeners, we have a link on our webpage to it. You go into great detail about how you were wrongly convicted.
Yeah, the website is http://johnmccarthy90066.tripod.com. But if you mess that up, all you have to do is Google John McCarthy, and out of about 8 million people, I'm number 4 or 5 on the list.
Yeah, and in addition to that, as we say, we have a link on this page so people can click over there without having to go through all that. You were in Special Forces.
Yeah, I entered the service in January of 1960. My dad had left the service in November of 59. And there was a shortage of funds and so forth, and a bit of a turmoil in the family at that point. I decided the best thing for me to do was to go ahead and go to the service. So
I went in 1961.
Yeah. Those days, were there wasn't any war going on that we knew about, although there was a war in Laos at the time that was a secret war. There was some advisor situations in South Vietnam, but they were rather limited in 1960. But I do recall one frightening time. We were about third week in basic training, and there was a class that we were attending immediately after lunch. And this was with Fort Ord, California. And most of us were sleepy and getting drowsy, and the subject matter was something to do with protocol, and oh my God, it was so boring, and the instructor was very, very boring to listen to, and all this was by design. All of a sudden, a guy runs up onto the stage, and he hands a message to the instructor, and the instructor reads off, says, "All leaves are canceled. The United States is now at war with North Korea. The North Korean divisions, totaling 800,000 men, have just crossed the 17th parallel, and all leaves are canceled, and you will, instead of having 8 weeks of the basic training, you'll get 2 weeks of rifle training, and you'll be put on board aircraft to go to Japan and then shipped to Korea to be the resistance force." And, of course, that woke us all up. Well, then they went into the program for that particular two-hour session, which was escape and evasion and how to act if you became a POW. So, of course, all of us paid strict attention. But that was their way of getting our attention. And, of course, it scared the hell out of us.
Sure.
My first thought was, I'm too young to die. I was only 17.
Yeah. later on, you went to OCS, I take it.
Yeah, I spent 4 years enlisted, made sergeant, and I spent my first 4 years in Special Forces, and my time in Germany was spent with mobile training team.
Yeah, the Cold War was still on hot and heavy, and of course we had the Cuban Missile Crisis during that time.
We did, and we had contingency plans to evacuate most of the military out of Germany and into France across the Rhine River. And what we were going to do as Special Forces was stay behind. We had earmarked all of the tunnels and bridges on the secondary roads in Germany, in the entire country. And we were going to destroy those in the event the East Germans and the Russians came across the border from East Germany. And this would force the Russians onto the Autobahn, the main turnpike system in Germany, and therefore they would be taken out by tactical air. So that was our function, to be stay-behind teams in the event that the balloon went up, as we referred to it.
Yeah, now, you actually had several... I guess, hazardous duty assignments. One of them got you in trouble there, and was that in Laos or in Vietnam where this incident happened with the pistol going off?
I was on my second tour in Vietnam in 1967, and in the course of events, one of the people who worked for us was... found to have a photograph of all of the Americans who were working on this particular project, and there were seven of us, and it had our correct names above our heads. We were in fact operating at that time under embassy cover as Department of Defense field evaluation.
So that meant you were in civilian clothes?
Absolutely.
Right.
And with cover identification, and we were under directions to have no open contact with any military in South Vietnam. And we thought this to be a legitimate portion of the cover for not associating us with this particular element, which happened to be made up of Cambodians. And these Cambodians were of a sect that was, in fact, the government in exile from Cambodia, very anti-Sihanouk. In fact, they had plans to assassinate him.
He was he was the head guy in Vietnam at the time, in South Vietnam.
Who was?
No. The man you're talking about, was he in charge in Laos? I'm trying to remember my history back there. Sihanouk.
Sihanouk was the prince of Cambodia.
Yeah, Cambodia, instead of Vietnam.
The king of Cambodia. Yeah. Okay. And so this team, we had scheduled training for them and provide them equipment to dress them up as North Vietnamese to conduct assassinations in Cambodia and in South Vietnam, and under the direction of the CIA when required. When I arrived to take over as case officer, which is the term the CIA military intelligence for being the head cheese for one of these organizations.
Kind of a section chief.
Absolutely. And so when I arrived in September of 1967, little to my knowledge, this organization was about to be disbanded, but it had been in existence since 1965. And if we can fast track just a bit to the year 2000, it turns out that documents from the Lyndon Baines Johnson's library, State Department documents that were once top secret and declassified by the State Department Department, much to the chagrin of the CIA, had verbatim minutes of meetings of the National Security Council from 1966, which was a year prior to my assignment at this project, which was referred to as Cherry. There were seven projects, all named after trees, and a bit more on that later. But the this conversation at the National Security Council with President Johnson and all the members of the Security Council in attendance, which means that the CIA, the State Department, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the FBI, the National Security Agency, and the Department of Defense, which is the military, was present, or representatives of those heads, if not the heads themselves. And Johnson's concern in June of 1966 was that he didn't want the war in Vietnam, which was heated up pretty good by then, about 150,000 of combat troops from the United States. He did not want it expanded into South, or into Cambodia. And this Cambodia comprised 60,000 square miles. And, of course, it's located directly west of South, of what was then South Vietnam. And on the other side of Cambodia was Thailand. So what he was concerned with was convincing Sihanouk that he did not want to assassinate him, even though Sihanouk at the time claimed that the CIA was organizing elements to do just that. And, of course, all of this was top secret, and nobody knew about it, and everything was compartmentalized back in 1966. Well, it turns out that LBJ, of course, directed the National Security Council and the members to carry information to the head of the Vietnamese government, to the head of the Royal Thai government, and letters hand-carried to Sihanouk himself in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, explaining that the United States had no intention of expanding the war in South Vietnam to Cambodia and had no intention of assassinating Sihanouk. And he wanted all the heads of state involved in this to know. Well, it turns out, 1967, in September, which was a year and a few months later, I was assigned as a case officer of Project Cherry, which had as its project, we had 12 Cambodians who were trained to assassinate Sihanouk. And these people were funded in violation of the National Security Council directives that the president gave them, that there would be no support, financial, logistical, military, or organization to assist them in operations against Cambodia, because that's not what Johnson wanted. So here I was, unwittingly, operating in violation of the president's directives, and in 67 he was still the president, and during the course of events, the third-ranking individual of this government in exile was, we attempted to get him hired by like organizations, because this system was shutting down in 67, supposedly for budgetary concerns, and during this process, this individual was found with the real names of the Americans in a photograph, plus some communications documents, which he should not have had.
In other words, he was a double agent.
Well, he was more than that. So in the process of taking him for interrogation, he was shot from outside the vehicle that we were traveling in.
Yeah, in your, on your website, you go into great detail about that, and evidently there was a motorcycle rider that left ahead of you.
Well, there, when we picked him up from his apartment, there was an individual there who should not have been there because of the strict protocol under which we were operating. This came up and had left on a motorcycle just prior to our departure with this individual, because I had told him that we were taking him to meet his new employer, because everybody else had been employed except him. So these people were in fact hired by what is called the Studies and Observation Group, or SOG, back the SOG, which is in violation of the 1966 NSC directives, because President Johnson wanted to be assured that there were zero commercial elements working in cross-border operations into Cambodia, because that would violate the trust and the word that Johnson was putting out to them in 1966. So what we have here is a government within the government deciding the hell with what the president wants. We're just going to go ahead and do what we want, because we want to expand this war and continue it.
In fact, as we continue in the show, we're going to get into that and show that's still happening today, I think. But go ahead with the story.
Okay. This individual was shot while we were on the way to the area where he used to be interrogated.
Now, you had a pistol.
Yeah, I had a .38 caliber pistol.
And it was, the sergeant was driving it.
Right. He had a 9mm, which is the same as a .38. Uh-huh. And I had a .38, which was over the back seat of the car. And all the windows were down in case we had to return fire. And a bullet came through the front windshield as we were driving. And this was at 3 o'clock in the morning. A bullet came through the front windshield. So whoever aimed at the car aimed it between the headlights, I guess, which is what we would have instructed them to do, which goes back to this guy on the motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
And he was hit, and we examined him, and it appeared that he was dead. But as soon as the bullet came through the windshield, I reacted and pulled off a round from my .38, which went out the left side passenger door.
Yeah,
the left side.
Your weapon didn't hit him at all.
No.
But they had a court martial, and they said you did.
Yeah, they had an expert witness who said that the 5mm hole was a contact type, which meant the muzzle of the weapon was either tightly or loosely, but in either case, up against the skin, and therefore, this must have been premeditated murder. Even though I had a .38, which is 9mm, and you can't put a 9mm bullet through a 5mm hole. So, a .22, which is what the diameter of the hole was, could either be made by a .22 caliber or a .223 caliber, which is an M16. There were 100 million M16 bullets fired during that war, and I'm sure we don't know where all of them went. But on this particular night, this one that came through the windshield and hit him, or came through the left rear window and threw him and out the windshield, I can't tell which one happened first one way or the other, but there was no powder burns or powder tattooing on the...
Now, this expert witness later recanted this?
Yeah, he did.
Did he ever say why he testified
that way? He didn't say why he testified that way, and nor did he say why he recanted. But his testimony before the court-martial compelled them to convict me and sentence me to life imprisonment, even though I was facing the death penalty. So, this was in January of 1968, is when the court-martial occurred. And it was a two-day court-martial, and on the second day at 7 o'clock at night, I was convicted and sentenced to life. And at 7:25, the Tet Offensive started. And that's when all hell broke loose all over South Vietnam. So if anybody is familiar with that period of time, they can realize when all this went down. In September of 1968, this doctor decided to recant his in-court testimony in writing. Now, strangely enough, this doctor was the first person to testify, the first witness. And he said this in front of the jury. He was a friend of the court. That was nice. Well, when this man wrote the recantation in September, which was 8 months later, he said, after reviewing the record of trial, I've decided that what I said was wrong and that it was not a contact wound and that the wound was probably caused by Captain McCarthy's .38, and the reason it was only 5 millimeters in diameter was because it shrunk and some other...
Kind of a magic bullet theory going in the 60s.
You won't believe how close you are to the magic bullet theory. Because this recantation, when it was found, was in 1970. So the trial was in January of 68. The recantation was in September of 68. And the good doctor decided he didn't need to talk to me or present me with his new findings, nor my attorney. But he did turn this over to Lieutenant Colonel Pierre Fink, who was the chief of pathology at Bethesda Naval Hospital in Washington, D.C. And this Colonel Pierre Fink had done the autopsy on John F. Kennedy in 63 and testified before the Warren Commission as to the magic bullet theory, which convinced the Warren Commission that Oswald was the lone gunman and that there was no conspiracy to kill our president. So this has come full circle with the magic bullet. Now, Pierre Fink, who is now retired and living in Switzerland, was questioned by my attorney, my military attorney, in 1968, and asked if he had any new evidence with respect to Dr. Mason, who had been the expert witness at trial. And he said no, he had no information, and yet this file was found mysteriously. My military attorney was having a cup of coffee in the Pentagon cafeteria, and this attorney from the Institute of Pathology came by and said, by the way, have you seen the McCarthy file in Pierre Fink's office over at Bethesda? And he said, hell no. He said, I've been told there was no file. He said, well, let's go. So they went over there, opened up the file in Colonel Fink's office, and the top file was the recantation by Mason. The second file was an FBI report saying that there was a piece of quartz found on the bullet fragment that Mason had submitted, which we didn't even know anything about, and that there was a piece of quartz...
That didn't indicate glass.
Right? That would indicate glass before it hit him.
Yeah.
That's called exculpatory evidence.
Right.
That means that it would have been impossible for me to do this because of those two documents alone. Now, there was other documents in there, but this file... was presented to the Court of Military Appeals, or the Court of Military Review, excuse me, which is the first step after a court-martial to review to see if they've done their proper deed. And the Court of Military Review determined that this was newly found evidence and fraud on the court, and they overturned a premeditated murder conviction on that alone. That was on the recantation. They didn't even address the FBI report. So what we have here is the Supreme Court decided in 1963 that Brady versus Maryland was a good law to have so that if there's any exculpatory evidence that comes out, it must be provided to the defendant. And that only seems right and just. But this forensic pathologist who testified at the trial, Dr. Mason, and forensic pathologist means he knows something about the coordination of medical and law. And this other guy, Pierre Fink, also is a forensic pathologist and knows something about medicine and the law. Both of them should have turned this information over to the defense counsel and to me because it eventually was used to overturn the now living in Switzerland.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Well, Dr. Mason is not retired.
Oh, really?
Up until last year, he was the coroner of Santa Cruz County and in Santa Cruz, California.
Near what used to be Fort Orange.
Yes. And he is... Now, he's not the coroner, but he's still doing the autopsies and testifying as an expert witness.
John McCarthy, we got to take a break. We'll be right back. I want to get to the question of why they prosecuted you to begin with. It just appears, really, that they could have let this gone on out the window. You know, I mean, obviously, there were a lot of, if you were looking for an excuse... Even if you had shot him, that we were in more or less a counterintelligence operation. It just seems strange that they...
If I'd have shot him, I'd have said so.
Yeah, I know. But, I mean, you know, it just seems to me they went out of their way to... It looks like they went out of their way to prosecute.
I'm responsible for a number of deaths in the name of the United States government, which I am not proud of, but not this guy.
Okay. We'll be right back in the car. Jim Mars,
consensus that, well, you know, if we use the ability to electronically capture airplanes and fly them by remote control against the wishes of anybody on board, and if we crash those planes into your buildings and you got double indemnity and, you know, more money out of them than they're worth, and we could use that as an excuse or provocation to start a war, hey, this would take care of everything.
Over the next few months, we are going to bring to the public the ugly face of what really happened on 9/11 and who is behind it.
Some senators have described this as a second Pearl Harbor.
There have been many excellent documentaries on 9/11. Many of these documentaries have uncovered much of the hidden secrets behind the story.
That had been planned for at least a year.
On our series, we're going to attempt to put a face on all of this. The people. Why they did it. Who did
it? We are not exactly sure at the moment of the whereabouts of the Secretary of Defense.
We will attempt to bring you the facts, plain and simple. Our 9/11 series will name the names. We'll tell you who did it. And we'll present the evidence to back up that story. 9/11, now on the Jerry Pippin Show.
John McCarthy is on the line from Southern California, and horrendous story, and as you said as we went to the break, you've had many other incidents, and for lack of a better term, I guess we call this black project operations.
These were black terror operations. False flag operations is another term for it. We were engaged in activities where we were blaming the North Vietnamese government for activities which were occurring in Cambodia in the hopes that the Cambodian government would eventually take action to refuse the North Vietnamese from using their country as sanctuaries and for the movement of material and supplies into South Vietnam.
Now, when we talk about false flag operations, we talk about your career, it brings up 9/11 and some other subjects which we'll talk about here in a minute, but first of all, Why did they want you out of the way, or what was behind this prosecution?
Well, first of all, I would not fall on my sword and admit that I had shot this person because I hadn't. And it turns out that since this was an illegal operation in violation of presidential directives, these people had their egos involved, and it's not real clear whether or not the people in Saigon who were actually directing these operations were even themselves aware of the NSC meeting.
In other words, someone back in Washington probably took up on themselves to take all of you guys out in the field out of the loop.
Well, that's the the way it turned out. Now, one of the State Department officials contacted one of my military lawyers in June of 1966 while I was recently arrived in Kansas, and he wanted a copy of the record of trial and all the Allied paperwork, which was provided to him. He took it back to the State Department, and within 10 days it was returned with a comment from the same State Department official, whose name I don't know. Had we known that this information was going to be discussed, we would have never let this go to trial. So this was an ego thing amongst the CIA folks who were actually operating outside the directives. This thing was a top secret court martial. There were very few people who knew everything that happened in that room except myself and the attorneys and the judge. In fact, the judge just passed away, and a couple of years ago, a friend of mine called him on the phone back in Tennessee, and he was a defense attorney back there, and a retired colonel, and he told him that he had a couple of questions about the McCarthy case, which, of course, had been overturned, and the judge says, by what right was that conviction overturned? Of course, because he was the presiding judge,
mm-hmm.
And my associate told him that Dr. Mason had recanted his testimony, and of course he was speechless, and he was, and his comments were related that he was really upset with the way this thing was conducted, because as it turned out, I was the first man ever convicted of premeditated murder, and the jury decided that they would sentence me to life in prison. And when the judge asked them if that was their complete sentence with respect to reduction in rank, dismissal from the service, and forfeiture of pay and allowances, they said, no, you said that life was a minimum, and that's what we gave him.
So you still were on the payroll?
Absolutely. I have true full pay and allowances for the entire period of time that I was in Leavenworth. But, I sent that home to my wife and family. But there wasn't much to spend it on there.
And of course, well, of course,
needed to survive. But when I was released in October of 1969, 6 days after President Nixon dismissed the charges against Colonel Rowe and seven other Green Berets who were charged with the same crime that I was charged with. And they were about to be court-martialed in South Vietnam for premeditated murder. And he didn't want them to be testifying, or didn't want the CIA to have to testify at their trial, so he decided that that was going to be the end of it. Well, turns out that Theodore Shackley, who was then the station chief in Saigon for the CIA, said that there was no reason for the CIA not to testify at that trial because they'd already testified in mine, so precedent had been set. The only problem with that is that everybody who swore the oath at my trial swore that they were members of the United States Army, so we've even got perjury thrown in there. So some of the people who swore that they were members of the United States Army were actually CIA. And those of us who were actually Army had been working for the CIA undercover. So that's how convoluted it got.
So in other words, they did all of this really treating you rotten, even though you had been a good soldier, simply just to cover their ass.
That's right. It was an ego problem, CIA problem. And of course, it all backfired. It took 30 years for it to backfire, big time, but it backfired within 3 years. When we found the letter of recantation, and of course that resulted in the charges being dismissed and a letter being written by General Westmoreland, a general order being written by him saying that all rights, privileges, and property that were removed as the results of the finding and the sentence would be restored. Well, that's fine, but you can't replace family. Once family's gone, that's it. And you can't replace the time. time.
Yeah, you're sitting there in prison. There's nothing you can do about that.
So that's just wasted. They never even said they were sorry. They didn't say thank you. They just said, well, you're going to be assigned to the...
Did you go ahead and stay in the service?
Oh, no. As soon as the charges were dismissed, I put in my letter of resignation with the qualification that I no longer had a desire to serve as an officer in the United States Army, period. And they granted my wish, and I left the service in August of 1969.
So what have you been doing the last 37 years or so?
I've found out that along the way that there's not much you can do with respect to seeking redress, which is kind of guaranteed by our First Amendment. And our forefathers decided that seeking redress against the government for redresses was pretty damn important, and they put it in the First Amendment. Well, in 1950, Uncle Sam, in violation of the First Amendment, which says Congress shall make no laws, decided that they would adopt the Ferries Doctrine, F-E-R-E-S, which means that they're... No individual who is in the military service may take civil action or tort action against any member of the United States government. So those of us who don our country's uniform to go off to fight wars automatically forfeit our rights under the First Amendment to begin with. And not a lot of folks know about that, but I put that on my website so that those being recruited to go off to fight, you know, wars of liberation, etc., are aware that what they're really giving up once they say I do. So these are the things and the elements and actually the basics of the reasoning for this website, which I've just about coming up on 800,000 visitors, many of which are from the East Coast and some of the agencies that are located there.
Yeah, I understand that.
Because my stat counter...
We look at our stats occasionally, and there's a lot of strange hits all of a sudden from Vienna, Virginia, and other places.
You get them from all over Virginia. You know, and State Department, too, right out of Washington, D.C., and FBI, and the rest of those, you know, jackbooted thugs.
Yep. And I understand what you're saying there. It seems that we are operating with a lot of thugs using mafia tactics under government.
Well, we thought we got rid of that with Nixon. And in actuality, I can actually believe that since this stuff is so compartmented that many folks don't know who, in fact, that they're working for. As a prime example, in 1962, we had teams returning from Germany, from Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, Turkey, and Greece. And I was in a position to know where these folks had been working and with whom. And one of the people who came back from Lebanon wrote to his father, who was then the Army Chief of Staff, General Goodpaster, and Billy wrote to his dad and told him what he had done, where his sister teams came from, and he took that letter into the next meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he said, hey, I didn't know we had Americans in all these countries. Well, 3 days later, we got a letter from SOTFI, which is a Special Operations Task Force Europe in Frankfurt, which is the CIA, directing the commanding officer of the 10th Special Forces in Germany to order Billy Goodpaster not to write his father any more letters about our operations in Europe, North Africa, or the Middle East. So that's when the light went on for me, that the Pentagon didn't know what the hell we were doing. And the same thing was happening in Vietnam. So we were an element of the United States government that actually was operating in a rogue status in many places all over the world. I think it's still going on.
Yeah, of course it is. It appears, and you would know more than me probably, appears that maybe it's even more refined and more more of a you know, the left hand not knowing what the right hand is doing.
Well, I think this is what Ike meant when he talked about the military-industrial complex.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, too. And I think many of the military things today are being done by privatization.
Well, that's another bad thing. Now, these were semi-privatization things that happened in Vietnam. Like, we had individuals working as civilians under the direct control of a civilian agency, the United States government, conducting activities which were illegal under U.S. law, international law, military law, and the laws of the country we were invading. So, you've got to...
And it's even worse today, I'm sure.
Well, it is, because now we've got these contractors which think that they're operating under blanket immunity because the heavy contractor and the payee is the CIA. And they're not. They're all subject to judicial action just the same as the rest of us. Well, these are the crimes that, you know...
Something needs to be done about it.
Well, you know, this, we've got to take something in hand here. The initial law which organized and brought it to being the National Security Act of 1947 is so far different from what we have today without any laws being passed to change what was put on the books in 1947, which established the CIA and the National Security Council, etc., and how they were supposed to function. And it's turned out that the thugs that eventually or initially took over these organizations were veterans from World War II, who were used to operating under the OSS auspices, which answered to nobody. And they had their 007 cards, and that's what they continued to operate under. But the United States, of course, was at peace and was not the aggressor nation. However, it turns out that we are. We have got interventions all over the damn world. And I've dedicated a portion of my website to just those activities.
I noticed that. Let's talk a little bit about 9/11 here. What do you think happened?
Well, when I got out of the service, I joined the police department in Miami, Florida, knowing full well that they would not hire me because of my past. Well, it turns out that they did hire me, even though my FBI rap sheet hit town 6 weeks into the six-month course at the police academy. And I showed them the order from General Westmoreland saying that all rights and privileges, blah, blah, blah. And so they kept me on. And I figured that they'd fire me, then I'd have an excuse to sue them to sue the government because of the screw-up that occurred while I was in the military. Well, it turns out, I arrested the wrong man about 4 years later. It was Janet Reno's gynecologist. And he had committed a couple of felonies in assaulting me because he was irritated with the fact that I was dating a certain lady. And so I arrested him, and she wasn't going to prosecute him. So I said, well, if you're not going to prosecute him, I'm not going to arrest him. And so I decided that it was time for me to leave. So then I went into to mining and engineering and heavy construction and got back on my saddle and toured around the world and saw things. In fact, I operated in a mining operation in Nicaragua during the late 70s just as the Sandinistas were taken over from the Nicaraguan government. So I got to see that action down there.
Yeah, and that wasn't very pretty.
No, it wasn't. The reason that the Contra War failed was because the United States, in its wisdom, decided to hire all of the former Guardia Nacional soldiers who worked for Somoza, who were suppressive to the Nicaraguan people. And when they came back into the country, armed to the teeth with all the proceeds from all the cocaine, drugs, and everything else that Ollie North and the Enterprise had brought in, the Nicaraguan people wouldn't have anything to do with them. They wouldn't support the Contras because they had been so suppressive to them when they were the Guardia Nacional, and they didn't forget it. So without popular support, forget the fact that they would have won the war.
Hey, let's get back to 9/11. What do you make of that?
Well, I wanted to say...
You're going to be out of the country here for about 6 weeks, and our series on 9/11 is going to start here pretty soon.
Okay. The reason I mentioned going into the police department is because a good homicide investigator always asks Keith Bono, who benefits from this homicide? And we have to ask the same thing for 9/11, and I've dedicated a portion of my site to Keith Bono. Benefits for 9/11, 7/7, etc. And when you look at it, you can see the information is totally available, but suppressed by the mainstream media, that there are people in the government today who benefited from 9/11. The fact that there was controlled demolitions, and this is an inescapable fact, because there's so much evidence of controlled demolitions, and some of it might even have been nuclear. I just finished up being a member of the Citizens Grand Jury of San Diego, and we indicted George Bush et al. For mass murder of 9/11. And we did that on the 14th of April.
Now you had evidence presented?
Yes, evidence was presented during a nine-hour session, and we in turn indicted George Bush, Dick Cheney, on down the line, including the military people who supported this and went along with it, and including Silverstein, who collected $7.5 billion. Giuliani for mass murder.
The Motorola radio thing alone.
Oh, absolutely. All this stuff was presented to us. Plus, a lot of the members of the grand jury had foreknowledge. We were asked to come and become members of this Citizens Grand Jury, which is part of the Constitution. And all of us had some knowledge and experience and had studied 9/11 and read as much as we could. And, of course, a lot of it was information that we found online because the mainstream media will not produce this information.
And why do you think that is?
Well, because the mainstream media is the ones that really controls this country.
See, I agree with you that that statement. I've been in the media for 45 years, and basically, I think they are guilty as much as anybody that put the mini nukes in there, or the controlled demolition, or whatever happened. I think by not reporting the facts, they're accessories.
Well, I think because
they're enablers.
What about the disinformation they put out, Jerry? I mean, they put out really horrifically bad information with respect to what was going down even at the process of the 9/11 factor. Dan Rather put out the fact that this looked like controlled demolition live on CBS, and he was fired shortly thereafter. And a lot of these people were saying, no, this, all of a sudden these experts appeared out of nowhere saying, no, this was from the fire and the steel melted and blah, blah, blah. Which is impossible.
Right. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up, we only have about 5 minutes left. We're going to do another show about this in great detail when you get back. But the reason I'm bringing this up is you have a history of working in highly compartmentalized operations where people really didn't know what the other people were doing, as we laid out in the first part of the story. Surely there's somebody in the media, in the mainstream media, that has a conscience. I mean, Rosie O'Donnell just got her contract not renewed today. But the point is, anytime somebody says something about 9/11, they seem to disappear.
Well, they do. And, of course, none of us get out of this life alive. And I've been fortunate to be around for 64 years, and I'm not afraid of anything. Although I'm not going to stand out in front of a bus.
Yeah, right. There's a difference between fear and being logical.
But my mother always said to wear clean underwear, you might get hit by a bus.
My mother told me to. That explains our no fear genes.
Well, I'll tell you, I'd be happy to come back and get into this further, Jerry. I would encourage people to take a look at the 9/11 section of that site. And if,
John, what are we going to do? Who are we going to get to talk?
Well, you know, once we start indicting, and when the indictments come down, there'll be people who will be shaking in their boots who are still alive today, even from back in 66. So when we can get all of these folks, in fact, we could. What I suggest.
Well, there's no statute of limitations on murder.
None. And what I suggested at the Citizens Grand Jury in San Diego is that we use extraordinary rendition for these people that we're indicting. I think we could get some quick answers. And since it's our money and we're sending people.
Is there any attorney general, U.S. attorney, anybody with the power of a subpoena in Congress that we can get mobilized?
Well, if we can, you can count on the mainstream media to be against it, because these are the guys who elect our presidents. The mainstream media controls this country, and that's why the people in power defer to the media all the time.
Well, John, we're out of time here, but the picture you paint through experience is not a pretty one.
Well, I'm sorry. It's the truth.
Yeah, I know it is. I know it is, and people, it amazes. We only got about a minute left, but when I talk about these things, people say to me, "Well, I can't imagine my government doing this, or I can't imagine the police department doing this, or I can't imagine the military doing this." Well, I can't imagine them not doing it. Human nature is human nature.
Yeah, well, I think we just scratched the surface, Jerry. If we had about 20 hours, we might get a lot of it in.
Well, we're gonna talk to you again when you get back from Germany. Be careful.
All right.
We'll talk to you later, John.
Thanks, Jerry.
Okay, bye. Jim Mars on 9/11.
It's got to be a consensus that, well, you know, if we use the ability to electronically capture airplanes and fly them by remote control against the wishes of anybody on board, and if we crash those planes into your buildings and you got double indemnity and, you know, more money out of them than they're worth, and we could use that as an excuse or provocation to start a war, hey, this would take care of everything.
Over the next few months, we are going to bring to the public the ugly face of what really happened on 9/11 and who is behind it.
Some senators have described this as a second Pearl Harbor.
There have been many excellent documentaries on 9/11. Many of these documentaries have uncovered much of the hidden secrets behind the story.
That had been planned for at least a year.
On our series, we're going to attempt to put a face on all of this. The people. Why they did it. Who did
it? We are not exactly sure at the moment of the whereabouts of the Secretary of Defense.
We will attempt to bring you the facts, plain and simple. Our 9/11 series will name the names. We'll tell you who did it. And we'll present the evidence to back up that story. 9/11, now on the Jerry Pippin Show.